Good afternoon, and thank you for standing by, and welcome to the State Discussion on Alternate Care Sites. As a reminder, today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. Your lines are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. At that time, you may press star followed by the number one to ask a question. Please unmute your phones and state your first and last name when prompted. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Ellen Marie Whelan. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you, Michelle. Since we don't have a whole lot of folks on the phone, we thought we would go through and do a bit of a roll call for the states. For those of us in the federal government, you'll hear from us and we'll introduce ourselves as we go through. But we thought we just wanted to let everybody know who else was on the line. For expedience sake, what I'll do is I'll call out the states, and if the state Medicaid director could introduce himself and then just let us know who else from your state you have on the line. I think that'll help us get through as fast as possible. So why don't I go alphabetically, and I'll start with Colorado. Do you have anyone from Colorado on? Okay,
Do you want me to open up all the lines right now?
Oh, actually, yes. Thank you. That would be
okay.
Good.
Sure. One moment here. And all lines are open.
Thanks. Let's try that again. Do we have anyone on the call from
Bill
Colorado?
Logan.
Hi, Bill. Who else do
yes.
you have from Colorado? Is it just you?
This is Chris Underwood from Colorado Medicaid.
Great. How about Connecticut? Do we have Kate McElvoy or anyone from Connecticut on the line? How about Illinois? Anyone from Illinois?
Hi. This is Ben Winnick, Chief of Staff with the Illinois Department of Healthcare and Family Services.
Hi, Laura Phelan, Illinois Department of Healthcare and Family Services Policy.
This is Eric Lorenz with the Illinois Emergency Management Agency Legal.
Okay, thank you. How about Kentucky? Anyone from Kentucky?
Yeah, this is Adam Mather, Inspector General for the Cabinet for Health and Family Services, and Tricia Okeson, who's the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Public Health, is on as well.
Thank you. Welcome. How about Louisiana?
Hi, this is Tara LeBlanc, the Interim Medicaid Director. And there's a couple other folks that can identify themselves.
Michelle Miley, Executive Staff Officer for the Bureau of Legal Services in Louisiana.
Blake Kramer, Franklin Medical Center.
Jerry Phillips, Rural Hospital Coalition.
Brenda Leffa, Bureau of Rural Hospital Coalition.
Kim Sullivan, Louisiana Great. Department of Health Legal.
Ruth Johnson,
Thank
Under Secretary, Louisiana Department of Health.
Louisiana is well represented. How about Maryland? Anyone from Maryland? How about Maine?
Bill Logan, the Director of Compliance for the Office of Maine Care Services.
Thank you for joining. Michigan? Do we have anyone from Michigan? How about New Hampshire?
Yes, Henry Lippman, the Medicaid Director, and Elisa Cohen is out there, the Deputy Director.
Great. Thank you
for
joining. How about Utah? And we'll go back. Anyone from Colorado?
This is Chris Underwood with Colorado.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for joining. How about Maryland? And any other state that I missed? Well, thank you all for joining. We really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today. To kick us off, I have the great pleasure of introducing you to the newest member of our CMCS Office of the Center Director.
Judith Cash, who just this week will be our acting deputy director for the next couple months. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon, and Judith, I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks, Ellen Marie, and let me echo your welcome. We're delighted to have this opportunity to talk with you this afternoon. It sounds like we have a nice mix of Medicaid experts, as well as some legal colleagues and colleagues from hospital coalitions, so we're delighted to have you. This is a really important call for us, and we're glad that you're here, and we're really interested not only in sharing information with you, but also hearing your questions and your comments as we go through this information. So I really appreciate your being here. I also want to acknowledge and call out Jack Rollins and our colleagues at the National Association of Medicaid Directors, who in so many ways have been great partners with us throughout this public health emergency and in so many other ways. And we're delighted that Jack is with us on the call and really helped to bring us the idea to have this conversation with you today. So thanks, Jack, for being here. So I think today we're looking forward to hearing not only from some of my colleagues here at CMS, but also from our colleagues at the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, and the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, who will talk about funding issues related to alternate care sites. And a lot of these care sites have already been set up, some in your states, across the country since the early spring to address some of the capacity issues related to COVID-19. Since the beginning of the public health emergency, as many of you know, CMS has released numerous documents describing regulations on establishing and operating ACSs, as well as a host of fact sheets, FAQs, we've done webinars, and really have tried to provide as much guidance as quickly as we can on a number of issues. And we often find that as we are working hard to get guidance out, it's really helpful to have conversations like this in follow-up, just to make sure that we've addressed the issues and we've given you what you need to be able to fully use that guidance and implement your programs. Some of the documents that I've referenced are linked in the appointment that you have for this conversation, and so they're available to you as resources. But since there is so much information, we really thought it would be helpful to walk through some of the key content and then give time for you all to ask questions and hopefully for us to answer those questions as you may have them. So you just heard from Ellen Marie. She, of course, is CMS's Chief Population Health Officer, and she'll start us off with an overview of the alternate care sites. And then we'll hear from our colleagues both across CMS as well as from FEMA and ASPR. And we'll stop along the way to be able to open the lines for questions. So please don't be shy. As we're going through, jot down your questions as you have them. We'll open the lines in between speakers as well as at the end so that you'll have plenty of time to answer your to ask your questions. So with that, I think I'll turn things back over to Ellen Marie to get us started.
Thanks so much, Judith. So I'll just flag again that in the appointment invitation, you'll see an agenda, so you'll be able to track who's speaking and what we're talking about. As Judith noticed, we'll take questions after each set of speakers, and then we'll have a general discussion at the end as well. So there may not be questions, clarifying questions in between, but we just wanted to make sure that this call is for you, and we wanted to make sure that there was opportunities to answer the questions. I'll just quickly note the three documents that are linked in the agenda. One of them CMS wrote specifically for state and local governments back, I think, in May, and it was on programs and payment for care that is delivered at alternate care sites. It's a really good document there. And then there's two documents from ASPR Tracy. You'll hear from those folks at the end of the call. But one of them is a tip sheet on funding for both establishing and operating alternate care sites, and the other is a set of slides from a webinar that we did back on that topic in May. So they'll be helpful background for the conversation. And it's probably basic, but just to level set and make sure we're all on the same page, I just want to quickly walk through some very basics about the alternate care sites before I hand it over to the experts. We use this term to describe any building or structure that's temporarily converted or newly erected for healthcare use. There's also other, sometimes referred to as temporary expansion locations, temporary expansion sites, field hospitals, or a variety of other names. It's important to note that most ACSs developed during the public health emergency have been both established and operated by existing hospitals and health systems, and they follow CMS's Hospital Without Walls guidance. And this is one of the many provisions that CMS has released to help hospitals maximize and expand existing capacity. The CMS Hospital Without Walls waiver allows already enrolled hospitals and health systems to treat ACSs as a temporary expansion of their existing brick-and-mortar location. In these circumstances, the local hospitals and health systems operate, staff, and bill for the care furnished at the alternate care sites. In these instances, Medicare and Medicaid pay for the covered health services furnished at the ACS the same way they pay for care delivered in traditional hospital settings. In contrast, some of the states and local governments have established an ACS, and while the state and local governments may establish an ACS, who and how the ACS is operated will determine if the services delivered at the site can be reimbursed by Medicare and Medicaid. So I'm going to turn the call over to Lisa Tripp and Haesun Lee, who will provide details on how the reimbursement occurs for Medicare and Medicaid at CMSs, at ACSs. And then just to kind of to do the overview, we'll then turn the phone over to Todd Wells. He'll describe how FEMA public assistance may help cover some ACS costs. We'll then go to questions after that, and then we'll wrap up the call with Shane Brandman, who will describe some of the resources at her shop that ASPR has compiled. And then we'll end with an even broader Q&A. So, Lisa, I will pass the mic on to you.
Thanks, Ellen Marie, and I'm very happy to be here today to talk with you all about the situations where Medicare will reimburse for services delivered at alternate care sites. Most of this comes from the massive blanket waivers that we issued on March 30th, and so that would be a great reference. But I'm going to break this out by kind of hospitals first, as a general matter, and then states and municipalities afterwards. So in terms of the situations where Medicare will reimburse for services provided at alternate care sites, one category is in parts of hospital buildings that are not normally used for patient care. And if you were to look at our waiver documents, this would be described as the physical environment waiver section. And what that provides is that CMS will permit facility and non-facility space that is not normally used for patient care to be utilized for patient care or quarantine, provided the location is approved by the state for the purpose of ensuring that safety and comfort for patients and staff are sufficiently addressed and is consistent with the state's emergency preparedness or pandemic plan. So that covers, you know, places in the hospital that would normally not be allowed to be used for patient care, but obviously for concerns around capacity, we have approved that. The next big bucket is really sort of outside of the walls of the hospitals, including temporary expansion sites. And if you're looking at our waiver documents, that's going to be in the temporary expansion site, part of the blanket waivers. And that says, as part of the CMS Hospital Without Walls initiative, hospitals can provide hospital services in other healthcare facilities, for example, like adjacent office space or some very other, you know, close office space or otherwise, and sites that would not be otherwise be considered to be part of a healthcare facility, or they can set up new temporary expansion sites to help address the urgent need to increase capacity to care for patients. So the last place that I want to highlight that's outside of the walls of the hospital is the patient's home itself. We've done a couple of things that are very innovative to try to respond to the public health emergency with respect to allowing for reimbursement for care in the home. Both outpatients as a blanket waiver and inpatients through the new individual waiver process that we announced on November 25th are eligible for reimbursal. The blanket waiver provisions with respect to outpatients doesn't require hospitals or states or localities operating hospitals to get a waiver. But with respect to the inpatient acute hospital care at home, that we are only granting on an individual waiver basis. And there is a waiver request portal that you can find on our website, or that interested parties can find on our website. So we're in the process of standing that up now. As I mentioned, that just started on November 25th. Now I'm going to pivot to situations where Medicare reimburses for care related to states and municipalities. So states can certainly use their own state hospitals to take advantage of the waivers that I just discussed. States can also partner with other Medicare-certified hospitals to provide care at alternate care sites. This is what, when we were trying to sort of figure out how best to respond to COVID-19, we thought that this would be an ideal provision where we would allow states and municipalities to partner with existing providers, and we thought that that would create a good coordinated healthcare strategy. Unfortunately, there were some barriers to implementing that, so the uptake of the partnership option was not as significant as we had thought initially. And then lastly, and states can apply to become certified hospitals, and the state of Maryland has done just that. So those are the three ways that states and municipalities can have care reimbursed at alternate care sites. What we can't pay for is situations where states are providing or paying for care, but there is no certified hospital, either a government hospital or a partner hospital, and the state has not gone through the hoops to become its own certified hospital. Under those circumstances, Medicare can't reimburse for that. So I'll stop there, and I'll turn it over to Haesun Lee to discuss the Medicaid implications.
Thanks, Lisa. Hi, everyone. So just kind of emphasizing the theme that Lisa was talking about with regards to the operation of a alternate care site, whether it's operated by an established hospital versus not. We have advised states that want to take advantage of this opportunity that if the alternate care site is run by a hospital, no additional action is required by states. States can pay the same inpatient rate as reflected in their state plan, and if they choose to pay a different rate, they will need to submit a disaster release law. And then similar to Medicare, for those alternate care sites that is not run by an established hospital system, Medicaid would not be able to pay for those inpatient services provided at that non-hospital site. Ellen-Marie, I'll turn it over to you to see if people, you want to open up for questions.
Yeah, thank you. Michelle, so before we turn it to FEMA, let's ask if there's any clarifying questions about Medicaid and Medicare reimbursement at alternate care sites. And there may not be, but I just want to make sure that we can clarify questions as we go along.
Thank you. At this time, if there are any questions or comments, you may press star 1. Please unmute your phones and state your first and last name when prompted. Again, star 1 for any questions or comments. One moment, please.
Thank you.
Brooke Belanger, you may go ahead.
Thank you. I had a question about hospitals operating the sites. I thought I read in some of the guidance that one hospital had to be identified as a lead. In other words, multiple hospitals couldn't co-run a facility. Is that accurate?
Lisa, would that be you? Yeah. CM colleagues. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Lisa.
Oh, no, you please go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I don't know if this is Will Robinson from the Center for Medicare. I don't know if my colleague, Sarah Blackford, is still on, but I think the answer to that question is that it's slightly complicated in that there are examples. For example, I believe Ohio State University has a relationship with a couple other hospitals where they have plans where they run the facility together. And I think from a Medicare standpoint, what's important is that the sort of lines that they draw between the sort of sections of the facility that they run and the patients that they are responsible for are really clear. And they have that circumstance. And Ellen-Marie, I don't know if we can find the. I believe that that person from one of the hospitals in Ohio was spoke earlier on a like, and by earlier I mean like in April, on a on one of our office hours calls. But they had it. They have sort of years of working and planning for. A sort of disaster-like scenario with these other institutions to have one of these co-managed sites. But again, I think the sort of short answer is that like it's a little complicated, but generally speaking, I think it would be allowed as long as the hospital at the hospital sort of together have clear. Delineation of the sort of sections of the facility that they are running and the patients that they are responsible for and are also sort of clearly allocating the costs across those sites or across those hospitals that are doing that. So sorry for the long-winded answer, but I think, I don't know if Carol is still on and wants to add anything else.
This is Carol. No, that's absolutely correct. And Will, we should go back and look to see if we have any FAQ documents or reference material that gets into the complexity that we can share with everyone on the call. So we'll take that back as an action item.
Thank you.
And we'll say at the end that there will be a couple different ways to get in touch with them, but one of is to contact your state, your Medicaid state lead, and they can help coordinate additional answers. So we want to make sure that if we don't answer something on the phone today, we can get you the answer later. Michelle, do we have any additional calls during this for our CMS colleagues?
We have a few more questions. Martin Judd, you may go ahead.
Thank you. I'm Martin Judd. I'm the Chief Operating Officer at the Metro South ACF in Illinois. I was also the Chief Operating Officer at the McCormick Place ACF in Illinois when that was active. In Illinois, we have attempted to partner with hospitals without any takers. I think there has been, concern on the part of the hospital community that taking something like this on would create significant liability cost and potentially distractions for those hospitals. So in doing so, we've tried to explore other alternatives, including independently activating and operating the ACF and creating a revenue cycle program around that. But it seems terribly complicated and also something that perhaps may not necessarily be doable given the what I understand are the needs to comply with Medicare conditions of participation for a hospital. Could you perhaps expand upon that? And if there are examples of where this has been done, it would be great to understand that as well and how that was done.
Hey, this is Lisa. I'm so sorry. I think I lost you for a second at the very end when you were phrasing your question. Would you mind just restating it for me? I'd greatly
sure. At this point, we've tried to partner with other hospitals in the mm-hmm. in the state, and that has been unsuccessful. So the only alternative left in Illinois would be to become an independent approved provider.
Yes.
But as we understand it, there's a need to comply with the CMS conditions of participation for hospitals.
Yes.
And if you could expand upon that and what's required, and if that's been done successfully elsewhere, where there has not been a hospital provider, we would want to understand that.
Sure. The state of Maryland actually went that route and became a certified hospital for and you're correct. There, you want, the hospital does have to you know demonstrate somebody seeking a hospital seeking certification for Medicare reimbursement purposes has to demonstrate it can comply with the conditions of participation. But we have had, because of the pandemic, we have had a significant number of the conditions of participation that have been waived. So it's not as onerous as it has been in the past. And so I am happy. I don't have the details of what Maryland went through, but I would be more than happy to try to make that connection if you think that would be helpful.
Yeah, I think that would be very helpful, particularly if there are waivers available and understanding what those waivers are.
Sure, I'll be more than happy to follow back up with you and again make that connection with the state of Maryland and also provide information about what conditions of participation have been waived for hospitals.
Oh, that would be helpful. Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And our next question comes from John Shannon. You may go ahead.
Actually, my colleague and partner, Mr. Judd, asked the very question I was going to ask, so I'll cede my time back.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Ruth Johnson. You may go ahead.
Thank you. My question is around the reporting requirements for Medicaid. We had gotten a copy of the document, I think that's used by Medicare because all the questions are related to Medicare and said Medicare fee for service. Has Medicaid put out reporting requirements, or would hospitals that do hospital at home report and just substitute Medicaid fee for service and managed care in those questions?
Yeah, this is Haythan Lee. Oh, I'm sorry. Lisa, did you want to take that? Yeah, I just wanted to clarify the question that you're asking. Are you talking about the hospital at home model that was initially announced?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Yeah, there is no Medicaid reporting. It's on the Medicare side that there's reporting required of the hospitals that have been approved.
Okay, so on the Medicaid side, there is no required reporting?
No, there isn't.
Thank you.
And I think the reporting that you're talking about is the hospitals are to report to Medicare, right, on the census population, right? Is that
That's correct. And mortality rates and whatnot. Yes, ma'am.
Yes, yes. No, there is no Medicaid reporting. The waiver is a waiver of the Medicare rules of conditions of participation, and this is, since it's unique, and is a waiver that we're considering on a case-by-case basis. That is where
mm-hmm. All right. So in order to participate, so is Medicaid, for Medicaid participation, is there anything required? Do they have to submit a waiver to participate?
No, there is no waiver. No waiver on the Medicaid side.
Thank you.
And at this time, I'm showing no further questions.
Very good. So thank you for that question. And again, we'll have time at the end to answer more questions if they come up as you hear more information. So next, we'll move to Todd Wells. Todd is the Deputy Director of the Public Assistance Division in the Recovery Directorate at FEMA. So Todd, I'll hand you the mic.
Very good. Thank you, Ella Marie. And I appreciate the opportunity and invitation this afternoon. I have a chance to talk a little bit about the public assistance program and how we are providing assistance for medical care in the COVID-19 pandemic and for HCS in particular. So just to start real quick with a short overview of public assistance program. Public assistance, we provide grant funding to state, local, tribal, territorial governments and certain private nonprofit institutions, including hospitals and other medical care facilities as defined in regulations for the cost of emergency protective measures to address immediate threats that result directly from the pandemic incident. So these are the eligible entities that can apply to FEMA for public assistance funding for reimbursement of eligible costs. One thing to keep in mind, a question that's come up in particular in the pandemic, is with regard to for-profit entities, and FEMA PA cannot provide funding directly to for-profit entities, and questions come up in the context of for-profit hospitals. If an otherwise eligible applicant, whether it's a state, local government, or another PMP, contracts with a private entity for services that are eligible, we can then reimburse that eligible applicant for the cost of those services, and they would then pay under the terms of the contract for the provision of those activities. For medical care, this is generally an eligible activity under the public assistance program in major disasters and emergencies declared by the president. Under our existing policy, and this is primarily articulated in a document we call the Public Assistance Program and Policy Guide, which is posted up on our website, under our existing PA policy guidance, the focus is on provision of emergency medical care after natural disaster incidents. And that's really based on our experience of providing recovery assistance in upwards of 70 Stafford Act major declarations per year. For the pandemic being a different kind of incident, medical care for COVID is actually a direct result of the pandemic and is an emergency measure necessary to protect public health and safety from the immediate threats of the incident itself. So in order to meet the needs of the pandemic, public assistance, we have developed and issued some disaster specific policy to address the eligibility of medical care in the pandemic. So for COVID-19, eligible medical care costs include the equipment, supplies, and other costs that are articulated in our regular policy. But under the COVID-19 disaster-specific policy, it also includes the eligibility for the reimbursement of clinical care for COVID-19 patients. And this is when those costs are not covered by another funding source, whether it be another grant program through another federal department or agency, or insurance, whether it is private patient insurance, Medicare, Medicaid. So that's just one thing to keep in mind for public assistance overall, is that in the pandemic, we can provide assistance that's eligible for public assistance, but so long as there isn't another funding source that is providing assistance for the same cost. And as part of working together with HHS, very much appreciate the opportunity to work with HHS, CMS, and ASPR in particular in making sure we're providing some updated guidance with regard to PA eligibility for medical care costs associated with COVID-19. So under the COVID-19 medical care policy, and this is posted on the PA, on the FEMA website, if you go under disaster assistance, look for state and local governments, and then click on the policy guidance button, toward the bottom of the list, there will be a link, COVID-19 guidance. And if you click on that, it has a list of COVID-19 specific guidance documents and will include the medical care costs eligible for public assistance policy as part of that. So medical care that is eligible for PA funding over for COVID-19 includes both emergency and inpatient clinical care for COVID-19 patients. It includes the cost for purchase, lease, delivery of specialized medical equipment necessary to respond to COVID-19. PPE is also eligible for reimbursement, and we are providing a significant amount of funding through PA program for PPE, both to state and local governments and to PNP hospital applicants. Other costs include those related to disposition of medical waste. Labor costs can also be eligible when they're associated with medical staff providing treatment to COVID-19 patients, and there are stipulations within the policy for those circumstances for those specific costs that we can cover for staff time to include overtime of regular staff, straight time and overtime of temporary medical staff, and the cost of staff time that is contracted to provide treatment to COVID-19 patients. For alternate care sites in particular, under the medical care policy, PA can provide funding for the cost of temporary and expanded medical care facilities. When it's necessary to meet the needs of the pandemic, applicants can either expand current medical facility capacity or establish additional temporary capacity through some temporary space, as has been described previously. For PA funding, eligible costs include all of the items that are listed for the medical care facilities in the policy. And in the context of the ACS, this would be applicable to both COVID-19 patients and non-COVID-19 patients. When the purpose of the PA funding is to support the provision of emergency protective measures, in this case, the provision of medical care. So if a hospital needs some additional space to be able to treat COVID-19 patients, we can provide, in accordance with the policy, funding to assist with that. If a hospital needs expansion of additional space in order to maintain and secure enough intensive care treatment space within the established facility, then that is the reason why that we can accommodate treatment of non-COVID-19 patients in the alternate space when that alternate space is necessary to be able to maintain the capacity of the original facility to provide treatment to COVID-19 patients. Other costs for ACS include lease and purchase of the cost to secure the facility space, mobilization and demobilization costs associated with setting up and closing the temporary or expanded medical facility. Operating costs can be covered as well. And then maintenance as well for the temporary or expanded medical facility is reimbursable. So that is a quick overview of both public assistance program are the COVID-19 specific medical care policy and its applicability to funding that's available for alternate care sites. With that, I'd be glad to, again, additional information is available on the FEMA website, specifically through the link to the medical care policy. So we would refer folks to that in particular. But then I'm also glad to entertain any questions this afternoon. Thank you, Mary Ellen. Ellen Marie.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much, Todd. That was a great overview. Michelle, do we have any questions for Todd and FEMA?
Thank you. Once again, that is star one if you do have any questions or comments. One moment, please, for the question. Chris Underwood, you may go ahead.
Hi, everybody. This is Chris Underwood with Colorado. I think some of the confusion that we had early on that FEMA has come together to help us resolve is we were in the same situation as our other state partners, that we couldn't get a hospital to extend their license to our alternate care site at our convention center. And then we couldn't figure out how to license it ourselves. Going through the conditions of participation for a state agency to open up a hospital is quite the lift. And when we mapped them all out, we just couldn't do it, right? We don't know how to administer a hospital. We're a Medicaid agency. We're a state emergency operations center. We can't run a hospital. And we couldn't meet hardly any of the conditions of participation. But where we got stuck was we couldn't figure out how to get the FEMA reimbursement without the Medicare or Medicaid reimbursement, because there was lots of documentations and conversations of, well, if you can't bill Medicaid and Medicare, then FEMA won't pay because they're the payer of after Medicaid and Medicare. And so we kind of went in a circular until we had to sit down with FEMA and say, hey, we can get this thing licensed, but it's going to be a state license of what we call a community clinic that allows for beds, observation beds, but not true acute care inpatient beds. But that license type is not recognized by Medicare. And actually, under Medicaid rules, you can't bill for inpatient services under that license type. And once we sat down and worked out all the details with FEMA on, hey, you just can't bill Medicaid and Medicare, it's just not allowable, but yet we're going to have a legally licensed facility to provide these alternate care sites, they were able to come around and say, well, based on what you've presented to us, then FEMA will pay 100% of the medical costs, and you aren't responsible anymore for billing Medicaid and Medicare for those costs. And in addition, those costs may exceed the traditional Medicare rate for providing services, because our nurses who are in the alternate care sites are coming at a premium. And since we have contracts, though, in place approved by FEMA to pay for those medical care costs, they were able to then reimburse if we happen to open the site. We have not opened the site yet, but they are willing to reimburse at those contracted rates. So it took us a long time to get there. It took us about 3-4 months of negotiations and working through various licensing, but we've actually reached a point now where I think we've achieved the licensing and the FEMA reimbursement. So I just wanted to throw that out there for our other states that we can help work with you in those same conversations, or if FEMA has any comments about my comments that I just made.
Yeah, Chris, Todd Wells for FEMA. I do appreciate that. I know that the folks there in the Region 8 office are fully engaged, and they've been working hard through the pandemic. And you know, we look to support them as we can from FEMA headquarters. I think that your comments reflect some of the issues that we need to work through on the public assistance side to be able to get to a place where we can support funding. Things like legal responsibility of the applicant to be able to provide, conduct that work, as you indicate, and then also just ensuring that the work is conducted in the appropriate manner, such as as you indicate, the appropriate or licensing that's appropriate to the conduct of that that facility. And then we get to the point where we can look at eligible costs, and as part of that is what I'd mentioned previously is that we can't provide funding for costs that are being covered by another source, including Medicare, Medicaid. And in the instance that in your instance, there is not that coverage for Medicare, Medicaid. So we're not faced with a duplication of benefits, which were constrained under the law from providing. Then we can look at those costs that you've incurred as eligible under the medical care policy and provide a grant funding to provide that assistance. So I appreciate those comments. They're instructive in terms of highlighting some of the processes we go through on the public assistance program tonight.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Ruth Johnson.
Yes, this question is also for FEMA. I just wanted to clarify something. Earlier you stated that if the reimbursement was needed for treatment of COVID patients and to maintain enough intensive care and other services for other patients, but I think you were talking specifically about expanding the capacity of the building. Does that also cover covering the cost of staff?
It would include the cost of the staff at the ACS site, yes, if those costs aren't being covered by another source.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And once again, that is star one if you would like to ask a question. Our next question comes from Eric Lorenz. You may go ahead, sir.
Hi, good afternoon. First, I want to thank Todd Wells for his presentation. It was very informative. And then I was going to ask about what we do if we find ourselves – I'm from Illinois. I'm sorry if I didn't say that. Martin Judd kind of outlined our situation, which is very similar to where Colorado was finding itself, and I was – very enthusiastic to hear that Colorado has found a solution. I think we at Illinois are in a very similar situation, and I think we would like to start exploring those negotiations with FEMA. We're in FEMA Region 5. Do you have a recommendation for whom we should reach out to start those discussions?
What I can do, Mr. Lawrence, is I can reach out to Region 5, and if there is a way for them to contact you, I can identify the appropriate person within the region for them to reach out to you.
Yes, I'm the IEMA General Counsel, and I'm familiar with.
I've got you.
I mean, we have an on-site fit, so. They will know how to reach me and
all right, Eric. Yeah, I'm sure they know how to reach out to you. Yes, sir. I'll
okay.
Reach out to Five and have them give you a call.
Okay, and I'm going to alert Chris Underwood to the fact that the folks from Illinois will likely be reaching out to our counterparts in Colorado very shortly. Thank you.
And at this time, I'm showing no further questions.
Thank you, Michelle. And so we're going to close the meeting today hearing from Shane Raman. Shane is from the Office of Emergency Management and Medical Operations and the Director of ASPR Tracy, which is the Technical Resources Assistance Center and Information Exchange, or Tracy. She'll tell you about the work that they do and some of the resources available from her organization. Shane, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Ellen Marie, and good afternoon, everyone. And thank you for what you're doing daily to help your states and communities to overcome the arduous challenges that we're facing. ASPR's Technical Resources Assistance Center and Information Exchange is a technical assistance center focused on filling knowledge gaps in healthcare system preparedness. We have collected thousands of peer-reviewed resources available for review on our website, aspertracy.hhs.gov. AsperTracy has worked closely with the COVID-19 Healthcare Resilience Task Force and now the Working Group and other partners, both from the private and public sectors, to collate, review, promote, and develop relevant and timely resources to assist with COVID-19 preparedness and response efforts. As part of this effort, AsperTracy worked with subject matter experts to develop numerous resources related to patient surge management, including alternate care strategies and alternate care sites. Of particular interest to this group tonight is AsperTracy's funding summary for the establishment and authorization of ACSs. This is the link that Ellen Marie talked about earlier when we began this meeting. This tip sheet, developed in collaboration with ASPR's NHPP program, CDC, CMS, FEMA, and HRSA, discusses funding available through these organizations for establishing an ACS, operation and ongoing administration of an ACS, and for direct patient care costs. Working with our FEMA colleagues just yesterday, Megan Trever, who is also on the AsperTracy team, updated that document, and that document is fresh off the presses with updates as of yesterday. AsperTracy has also been speaking to states and organizations that have successfully developed and operated ACSs to gather their experiences, and those are also on our website if that is of interest to you. Please check out our AsperTracy resources at aspertracy.hhs.gov/COVID-19. But one thing I want you to remember, if you can't easily find something on the AsperTracy website, we are a technical assistance center. So you can reach out to us by emailing us, askaspertracy@hhs.gov, or phoning us, or doing an online form. And our staff are available during normal business hours, Monday through Friday, to rapidly assist you and get you the resources you need. With that, Ellen Marie, I'll turn it back to you for any questions anyone might have.
Thank you so much, Shane. And it's amazing the volume of resources that you have there and how helpful we have found them to be. So really appreciate the work that you're doing and encourage folks on the line to investigate and see what's there for them. So we'll open up questions for Shane and the information that they have at AsperTracy or any other general questions for any of our participants. We've got about 5 minutes left.
Thank you. Once again, that is star one if you would like to ask a question. Please unmute your phones and state your first and last name when prompted. Ruth Johnson, you may go ahead.
Yes, I'm sorry. This is a follow-up to that FEMA question on clinical care. So I just want to be sure. So if a hospital opens a wing that they didn't have before in order to expand for COVID patients and non-COVID patients possibly who also have an emergency situation, but because of the increase in census because of COVID, would FEMA cover the cost of that clinical staff care?
So, Todd Wells for FEMA again. I think it's going to be dependent upon some of the specifics of the individual case and just what the how that space is being set up and or managed. So if it is within the regular operations of a hospital facility, we would not look to provide funding for staff costs for non-COVID patients. If it is in the context of an ACS as a temporary or expanded space to be able to meet the needs of the pandemic, that's when we get to what we may be able to support. But it may just be dependent on the individual facts and circumstances of that particular situation.
And hey, this is Lisa Tripp. Ruth, I'll also add that
that scenario, and again, with the caveat that I don't know all the particulars of the situation, but as a general matter, sort of, you know, expanding to a wing of the hospital that had not been in use before, you know, but needed now because of COVID is a type of expansion that we would pay for, Medicare would pay for, pursuant to our waivers that relate to physical environment. So that should be something that we would pay for as a general matter, again, not knowing the particulars of the circumstances you're describing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And once again, that is star one if you do have any questions or comments. Our next question comes from Blake Kramer. You may go ahead.
Hello. Has there been any discussion of what EMTALA obligations are for alternate care sites? You know, typically it's frowned upon to move a patient from an emergency department to what's deemed to be a lower level of care. And some ACS sites might be viewed as that, since it might not be as at the same level of acuity with the same level of proximate services as a standard four walls hospital. I haven't seen anything about that. Wanted to ask the question.
Hi, this is Lisa Tripp again. I think I can help with that. So to the extent that you're describing the movement of inpatients to other places, that would not implicate EMTALA because EMTALA does not cover inpatients. It just covers folks as they are presenting to the emergency department. We did waive one part of the EMTALA requirement, which is the screening part, and we basically allowed emergency departments to screen off-site so as to keep COVID, COVID-infected patients from other patients. So we did do that. We did not waive the prohibition against transferring unstabilized patients, though. But I hope that's helpful. And if not, I'm happy to answer a follow-up question.
Yeah, I was thinking more of a patient who is in an emergency department and is deemed to need perhaps observation care. And the med-surg, there is no med-surg or ICU capacity that can really be found for that patient. So they're moved to the ACS. And, again, the ACS is not going to have the same technical capabilities as, again, a hospital that has, you know, immediate ICU and so forth capabilities there. I wanted to make sure that there wasn't any potential problems with that.
Yeah, I would say in this discussion, actually, we were having a discussion similar to this morning, and I apologize, my dogs are barking. You know, EMTALA, of course, requires hospitals to provide care and services within their capabilities. And so I think, and this would be a very fact-sensitive question, so I don't know that there's a great kind of broad answer, except to say that, you know, if it's impossible to provide necessary care and services or test at a given hospital, that is a basis upon which one can transfer. But the transfer has to be to an appropriate receiving hospital. And so I think there could be EMTALA implications depending on how that is done and whether or not, in fact, that the care and services were available at the initial hospital.
Thank you very much.
If you'd like to ask a question, please press star one and clearly state your name for question introduction. One moment.
While we're waiting for that person, I think this might have to be our last call. I'm looking at the clock and cognizant of everyone's time.
I have no additional questions at this time.
Perfect timing. Well, first of all, I want to thank all of my federal colleagues. This was extraordinarily helpful. We actually learned a lot by putting this call together. So we do want to thank Jack Rowling and the National Association of Medicaid Directors again for kind of springing this idea and having us put this call together.
As feedback, I'll, Mr. Judd, Martin Judd, I want to let you know that I did share your email address with Lisa Tripp, so we'll get in touch with you and share the information about the Maryland site. Also, for if anyone else has any questions, we've been mostly telling folks to reach out to their state Medicaid leads. And since this is a Medicaid call, we figure you all have a way to contact that person, and we've helped that person figure out how they can get in touch with all of the rest of the folks on the call there. My email address, Ellen Marie Whalen, is also in your invite. So if you have any questions, you can certainly reach out to me there as well. So thank you all in the state as well for the work that you're doing during this public health emergency surge. We really appreciate all of that. And thank you for joining us today. I wish you all a happy and safe holiday season.
This concludes today's conference. You may disconnect at this time. Leaders, please stay on the line for final line count. One moment.